Welcome all to the U.S. Institute of Peace. This is an on-the-record meeting of our Iraq Working Group, and we have the particular pleasure of Ambassador Ashraf Qazi to talk with us this morning, though I hasten to add only briefly because he has another important appointment to go to, I believe, at 1:15. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I don't do long introductions, but every once in a while something strikes me in the bios that we hand out, and certainly in this case something does strike me, and that is that Ambassador Qazi has served in the United States, in China, in India, in Russia, in Syria, Tokyo, Cairo, and London, just to name a few of the places. And if you think about Pakistan's interests in the world, you will realize that this is a very distinguished array of posts indeed. We are here with one of the real stars of today's diplomacy, and so I'll get out of the way and let him speak.
Dr. Serwa, dear friends, it's a great privilege to have this opportunity to come to the USIP. I've been here before in different capacities, usually accompanying a foreign minister of mine, but I was in a previous incarnation. But now I'm greatly privileged to have this opportunity to have been invited by you to come here and speak a few words about the world's most salient issue, the situation and future of Iraq on the third anniversary of the MNF invasion or liberation. That depends on the political point of view. But I think this is now an opportunity for everybody to stand back and see how things have worked out over the past 3 years. I have been in Iraq since August of 2004, so I've been there a year and a half, which makes me a veteran because most people come there for 6 months, 3 months, 9 months. Few have been there longer than I have, but not too many. And a lot has happened in Iraq during the past year and a half. As far as the United Nations itself is concerned, our presence, despite a security situation which hasn't improved and has arguably deteriorated, our presence has increased tenfold. It was we were 30 people in Baghdad when I returned with the international component of UNAMI, and I must emphasize the international component of UNAMI because the national staff of UNAMI never left, even after the tragedy of August 19, 2003, when we lost Sergio and his band of wonderful people, 20 people who are still recalled with great affection and sadness by the people of Iraq. Sergio was there for just a little over 4 months, and the indelible imprint he's left on the minds of the people he met with really has acted as an inspiration for us to try and realize the dreams that he and his team sacrificed their lives for. During 2005, 1546 had laid out a number of benchmarks or milestones to be achieved by the political transition process that included the January elections and then the convening of parliament, which would occupy itself with the drafting of a constitution, then a referendum, and then the December elections. All of these benchmarks were achieved more or less on schedule. In fact, on schedule, I mean, when the constitution was referred to parliament, we needed a few days and a few legal stratagems to ensure that it took place within the time frame. And this was a truly tremendous achievement of the Iraqi people, of the Iraqi parliament and government, and I would like to make specific mention of the Iraqi Election Commission and the Constitutional Commission and Committee of the TNA, the Transitional National Assembly, who really worked hard in order to achieve these benchmarks, which were laid out in TAL, the Transitional Administrative Law, which was the interim constitution, and the Security Council Resolution 1546. Having said this, it nonetheless remains true that the achievement of these milestones did not and has not translated into a better security picture or an improved political discourse in Iraq. And the challenges before Iraq are there. They're still there. Progress has been made, as I said, and that progress needs to be acknowledged and indeed saluted. But the challenges remain there. Therefore, the question is, how do we move forward? And for the United Nations, the question is, what kind of role can we play during 2006? Because as far as Iraq is concerned, it probably is useful to see things in a year-by-year context. During 2006, we need to build upon the accomplishments of 2005 and try and bring about a situation in which they can more effectively translate into better political discourse and an improved security situation, without which longer-term strategies for Iraq it'll be difficult for them to take root and develop a momentum. Electorally, of course, IECI, that's the Independent Election Commission of Iraq, will come to an end in May. That is 3 months after the final certification of the December elections, and a new permanent independent High Commission for elections will need to be stood up, and Parliament will have to busy itself with this important work, along with establishing other very important commissions, particularly the Independent Human Rights Commission. Now, the Electoral Commission will be required to sort of help and assist Parliament and its committees in the drafting of an electoral law for elections that will take place at the governorate level and at the district level. Those elections, we do not know exactly when they will take place, but they were, according to a draft law which was submitted to the presidency, they were envisaged as taking place 2 months after the formation of a government. But that was not that law was not accepted, and therefore this law will have to be resubmitted and, by the new parliament, and it'll be it's a very complex body of work, because the electoral model, as you know, has always been a tricky issue. But when you're going to talk about elections, and these will be hundreds of elections at the governorate and municipal levels, then you have to see what is the appropriate model, how will you delineate boundaries, and all of that. That'll take a lot of work. And then, of course, one of the criticisms of the elections was the voter registry, which was based on the PDS, or the food distribution system. That wasn't a perfect system. There were flaws in it. That'll need to be updated or revised, and ultimately the solution is a census, but the census is going to take several years. So a basis for elections at the governorate level will have to be provided by an updated voter registry. Again, a lot of professional work, technical work, will require some time. And therefore, it's quite possible that the governorate elections and all may actually take place either later in the year or in 2007. Constitutionally, the work of the OCS of ONAMI, that's the Office of Constitutional Support, will continue. We have a constitution that was approved in a referendum by 78% majority, but the fact is that the 22% that said no to the constitution were almost wholly from the Arab Sunni community, and a constitution is a national framework, a national basis for a compact amongst the peoples of a country. It does need to be much more of a consensus document than a majority-minority document. And therefore, in view of this fact, a constitutional review commission has been envisaged, which would be established after the convening, after the establishment of the new government, and that Constitutional Review Commission is constitutionally mandated to come up with recommendations within 4 months of its, the commencement of its deliberations. This, of course, is a tall order because you're aware of the sensitive issues that are involved, and therefore there's some discussion as to whether it should immediately begin its work, and if it begins its work, what should it concentrate on, the politically sensitive issues or on the more technical issues in order to improve some aspects of the Constitution, because the Constitution, in a sense, at the last moment was rushed to meet timelines, and some of the resulting language is therefore somewhat vague on important issues, and that needs to be clarified, and that can be done through legislation rather than through amendments if all the main parties are agreed. So should the review process concentrate on that and then wait for a more conducive or amenable political atmosphere in order to take up the more politically sensitive issues such as, federalism, the formation of regions, distribution of powers, distribution of revenues from national resources. All of these are issues that, whether they're postponed or whether they are discussed immediately, will have to be discussed, and there are downsides and upsides to doing so immediately or postponing them. This is something which the Iraqi parliament and government will be involved with as soon as the government is formed. Right now, of course, there is a government formation process going on, along with a very difficult ground situation in the aftermath of the Samarra incident of February the 22nd. The sectarian situation in Iraq has been a cause of concern for some time, and like many countries, there are always fissures in an overall national society or polity, but the sectarian or ethnic divide in Iraq is not something of recent provenance. It's been around for some time, but the threat that Iraq faces is that the sectarian divide, instead of remaining a part of the Iraqi political process, may come to define that political process, and that would be a real tragedy. And I think there's a challenge which faces the entire leadership of Iraq to rise to this occasion and to ensure that the political process is not defined by the sectarian or the ethnic divide. The average Iraqi transcends the sectarian divide every day. He deals with people whom he doesn't even care to ask whether they belong to this or that community. He has friends from his childhood. Intermarriages across the sectarian divide, as it were, are a common occurrence and all. The major tribes of Iraq are both Sunni and Shia, in many cases half and half. So Iraq, even though it hasn't had a strong democratic tradition, does have a secular tradition. It suffered and groaned under a tyranny, but that tyranny was a secular tyranny in many ways. It was a brutal tyranny, and they are hugely fortunate to be free of it, but to be faced with the abyss of a sectarian situation would sort of hugely compromise the prospects that have come before Iraq as a result of being liberated from the previous tyranny. So it is the number one priority for the Iraqi political process to ensure that this situation doesn't get out of hand. The government took some very important measures in the aftermath of the Samarra incident, which put a cap on the level of violence. And then including curfews, and also. There was an agreement on a large number of measures addressed to the media, to the religious leadership, to people of all from all walks of life to come together in this hour of crisis and not allow the perpetrators of the outrage and of the attacks on mosques in the aftermath of the outrage to defeat and divide the Iraqi people and deny them the prospects that they have every right to move towards to in view of the suffering that they have undergone. And I think even the security forces do need to be complemented in helping to contain the situation in this aftermath. However, the deeper causes do need to be addressed by the political situation. Otherwise, the sectarian situation could become as much of a threat to the stability of Iraq as the insurgency itself, and the two could mesh and together and reinforce each other. The other work that the United Nations has been helping with relates to the what are known as the 7B subjects of 1546, which are, standing up a human rights regime that meets international norms, helping with establishing the rule of law and training building the capacity of the relevant ministries to sort of more effectively deliver basic services to the Iraqi people, and this work will continue. These core activities of the United Nations will continue, including emergency relief, education, health. We have seven clusters based in Amman, which work with a whole range of Iraqi ministries at the central level, and will work with them at the governorate level. Also who are very active in coordinating donor assistance through the trust funds, the United Nations Trust Fund, which has received about $1 billion of trust funds and has dispersed 50% of them through their partners. That's the Iraqi government and ministries, NGOs, and other UN agencies, and particularly the national staff of UNAMI, 80 projects all over Iraq. So, we've done a lot of work there, but we maintain a low profile, and therefore our work is not always known, because a high profile translates into security risks, because on August 19, 2003, as you know, we got the final proof that we were a target, a high-value target. But low visibility, which is necessary because of the security situation, sometimes translates into a credibility problem, because people don't always see you and ask you, are you in Iraq? Are you in Baghdad? We don't see you. Well, one of the reasons they don't see us is because we try not to be seen too much. I think maybe we've got to try and strike a balance where we are seen and safe at the same time, and I think hopefully that opportunity will arise. In 2006 also, we are fortunate to see a parliament which is much more inclusive than the parliament which preceded it, because as you know, the Sunnis did not participate in the January elections, but in the December elections, Ambar, which had a 2% turnout in January, had an 83% turnout in December. An incredible piece of progress. But they have a lot of work before them, and we're going to assist them with the constitutional process. And I must here acknowledge the important role that the USIP has also played in this respect in organizing conferences which have enabled Iraqi participants to really sort of understand the issues and also understand the experiences of other countries that have dealt with similar issues and have become more aware of best practices, and hopefully all of this will enable them to interface with each other more productively and address and resolve some of these issues that have so far hampered the constitutional process. So we acknowledge that. I've been invited a couple of times by the USIP. Unfortunately, as I haven't been able to sort of leave Iraq at the time, so here's a nice opportunity for me to pay you a well-deserved round of thanks, for all the good work that you have been doing. Politically speaking, this constitution, this parliament is broad-based. But the political process will still require to be even more inclusive, because there are elements outside the political process that can be drawn in. And some of them have made, for various specific reasons, common cause with the insurgency. And it may be possible to reach out to people that have not been involved with criminal activity or terrorist activity, or don't have blood on their hands, as it were, but have grievances, you see. So it may be possible and may be very useful to find a way whereby these people can come into the political process. And one good effect of this would be to isolate the irreconcilables, to isolate the beyond the palers, among most of whom are foreigners, you know, and the few Iraqis that may also subscribe to those are very few in number. The larger number of people who have not come into the political process are people who, as I said, have grievances and maybe perceived errors of the past in policies, whether the disbanding of the army or the or the wholesale banning of a party, which was, because Iraq was a one-party state. So whatever your profession was, you more or less, in order to move forward, whether it was in education or in sports or in politics or in culture, you probably had to have either become a member or be closely associated. And therefore, after the regime changed, there was a certain vulnerability. And I think this subject does need to be revisited in a manner acceptable to all parties concerned. I think on the government formation process, we are getting close to, hopefully, a compromise arrangement in which everybody can participate. There are two main views. One is that a government of national unity should reflect the composition of parties in parliament, and that parliament then can invite others to join them. The other is that a government of national unity should subscribe to not only a program, but a decision-making process that consults with all the major political parties, especially with respect to strategic issues. And there was talk of setting up a policy oversight body, which might sort of, give guidance to parliament and government. Some saw this as answering to the needs of a government of national unity. Others alleged that this would be unconstitutional because there was no mention of such a body in the constitution, and undemocratic because it might derogate from parliamentary sovereignty. I do believe that a compromise can be worked out and is on the point of being worked out, which will allow, hopefully, a government of national unity or a broad-based government or whatever word you want to call it to be formed, hopefully, if not by the end of this month, then certainly before the end of April, because it's important that you have a broad-based, effective government to deal with the challenges which the country is confronted with. And so I'll stop here and take your questions.
Thank you very much. Let me ask those who want to ask questions to line up at the microphone. We need to have discipline in that respect, also because we have cameras in the room. It's easier for them. I ask you to keep your questions brief.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Ambassador.
Yourself.
My name is Raid Mohammed. I was born and raised in Baghdad, Iraq, and I lived in Mosul and many parts of Iraq. The curse that Iraq is situated in this fault line, between the Sunni world and the Shia world. And also within Iraq, there's another fault line. I met with President Bush back in January, and my suggestion was that at this point, the only people that can really help Iraq to be catalysts and facilitators from behind the scene, Iraqi-Americans and Iraqi-Europeans, who every single individual of them come from diverse background. The mother is a Shia, the father is a Sunni. They have dealt with all these groups. They look at it objectively, and they don't look at each issue from a narrow angle, a narrow-minded angle, because if there's ever a civil war in Iraq, the civil war in Lebanon will look like kids play. And thank you.
Thank you. Let me take two questions at a time.
Adil Awad, Radio Sawa. It seems obviously the challenge that faced the political process in Iraq is the presence of armed militias and the violence as a result of their presence. And lately we've seen escalation in the attacks against the Shia. Last one was in Medina al-Sadr, more than 300 people between dead and injured. Yesterday, Khalaf al-Aliyan, whom of course you know, one of the most important Sunni leaders in Iraq, denied that Sunni militias are the one who doing such attacks, and he accused the U.S. and the British of standing behind them. So I wanted your view of his accusations, and also lately we heard a statement from you saying that not only Shia in Iraq have militias, but others also have militias. Does this mean that Sunni parties who are now in the political process also have militias? Thank you.
First of all, I think I'd like to talk about the so-called drift towards civil war, which was alluded to. I believe that that prospect is certainly not there, alhamdulillah, God be praised. And but a very serious situation does exist, which if not addressed, could lead to the breakdown of law and order, the breakdown of governance, and bring about a situation of that would approach anarchy. I think if all the political leadership and the government, those in government, are hugely aware of the situation, and aware of the fact that they need to take measures in the immediate run as well as in the short run to avoid that. And it is correct, as you say, that the Iraqis who live outside of Iraq don't think in sectarian terms. But as I mentioned earlier, Iraqis inside Iraq also, individually, and I'm sure you know, who know that, who know that, as I said, they transcend and reject this sectarian politics every day in the way they conduct their lives and interrelate with their neighbors. Yes, the politics of Iraq has become identity-based more than issue-based. But Iraq has a very strong self-image of having a secular tradition. And I think that and the fact that Iraq's potential is so huge that it can offer a truly grand prospect for each and every Iraqi, that I think this, and the alternate is absolute black despair, because God forbid Iraq were anything to happen. No, but there would be no gainers within Iraq. There would be no gainers. So therefore, whatever the challenges of the moment, and they are serious, and you cannot afford to be complacent, in the longer run, I have no doubt that the Iraqis and their leadership will rise to the challenge, if only because they have to. But having said that, of course, that's not a guarantee. They have to agree on strategies and put together a government of national unity, which is workable and which answers to the needs of the people and sets out their priorities in the next, let's say, national development strategy and is able to implement programs. So you can't just sit back and make a generally abstract point that we have to succeed because we have no alternative. That's not a guarantee. You've got to really then work towards it, and then you will. As far as the militias are concerned, yes, the militias are a reflection of this situation. And constitutionally, the militias are banned. They're not illegitimate. They're not supposed to be there. In many cases, the militias are seen to have become part of national or regional forces. And even though militias are not permitted to enter into forces en bloc, it is possible that people apply individually, in large numbers, but happen to belong to some militia background. And in practice, they may answer to, authorities other than the formal authorities they're meant to. So the problem of militias will have to be addressed, but that can only be addressed if the security situation is improved. And, of course, there is a whole, the MNFI, and particularly the U.S., and other countries are involved in training and standing up the ISF, you know, including the Iraqi police, and this and the whole idea is that they will take over increased responsibilities, which will allow you know, a drawdown of foreign forces to take place in Iraq. So that is, as that happens and as success attends to this policy, the militia problem hopefully will be addressed. And when and if I am not aware of the quotation you referred to me, but of course militias are not a purely Shia phenomenon. You know, there's the Peshmerga, etc. You know, I'm not aware of specific Sunni militias as such, although there's a lot of talk about that. And of course, in such a situation, the all communities want to sort of see how they can best protect themselves. So even where the, and unless the situation is addressed, militias that don't exist may come into existence and all. So, so we want to demilitify the ministries and the politics of Iraq, and that is one of the major themes of the present government formation process. Khalifa Ali, I don't want to sort of, because I haven't seen the statement myself, so it's best that I don't comment on statements that I haven't seen.
Two more, please.
Mohammed Al-Minshawi from Tahrir, Washington. Will you play any personal role yourself or the UN in the expected dialogue between Iran and the United States regarding Iraq?
No, I think this is
it. Let me take
yes.
Again.
Yes.
Anthony Sennett with the Lincoln Group. And we do a lot of empirical social science research on the ground in Iraq and elsewhere. And one of your comments, Mr. Ambassador, intrigued me about reaching out to people who don't have the blood on their hands in Iraq to try to find a way to reconciliation. I wonder if you contemplate a UN effort to help identify those grievances and help point a way to reconciliation of otherwise innocent parties.
Thank you. I want to insert, if I can, a third question this time around, and I'm particularly concerned to insert it because I'm writing a paper in which I have to answer this question, so I'm curious as to your response. And the question is from Ambassador Hassouna of the Arab League. How could the Arab League help?
Very good. This is an initiative which has been in the works for some time, and I'm very glad to see that Iran has responded positively, because both the United States and Iran do have impact on the situation in Iraq, and they have a stake in the outcome of the processes that are underway. And there's always, it's a good thing for people to talk about each about issues, even if they have their differences. So this is a very positive development, and this is something that is going to happen between Iran and Iraq. The UN is always ready to facilitate processes if it is asked to by the parties, but I do not myself immediately perceive a direct role. We are, however, establishing or in the process of establishing a regional contact group, which will be comprise Iraq's neighbors, and that contact group is envisaged to meet at regular intervals in Iraq. It's still in its, you know, it's an embryonic idea right now, so don't ask me any details which have not yet been agreed upon. It's a proposal, because the ministerial meetings of the regional countries or the neighboring countries takes place at sort of, you know, at after long intervals, you know. So it's good to have a working level forum which can actually facilitate and provide input into the ministerial level meetings, and also activate the role of regional countries with regard to Iraq, because they impact on Iraq and Iraq impacts on them. So within that context, and if they come and these meetings take place in Baghdad, this will afford an opportunity for these regional countries to meet with, you know, other stakeholders who may not be formal participants in the political process. As far as reach out is concerned, we meet with a whole range of people in Iraq. I've had the pleasure of visiting the Grand Ayatollah Sistani in Najaf on three occasions, and I've met with Muqtada Sadr, and on the other hand, I've met with people like Haris al-Dari of the AMS in Baghdad, and a lot of people get in touch with us who
We cannot be always altogether sure of their backgrounds, but I mean, we listen to everybody. But we are always ready there, and part of our mandate is to facilitate dialogue, compromise, accord, and reconciliation. And that's a broad mandate, and we're willing to bend every effort to facilitate such a process, but at all times we will do that in step with stakeholders. The Iraqi government has to be comfortable with that. The Iraqi political leadership has to be comfortable with that. Iraqi people and similarly other stakeholders, because the UN doesn't define its role. The UN is given a role in terms of the UN Security Council resolution. And if you look at 1546, it's essentially a very important leading but advisory role, not an executive role. So we do have to remain within the parameters. There's a certain leeway in terms of interpretation, but we do not do things on our own. So within those limits, we try and make ourselves as useful as possible. And I think there is possibly developing political space for the UN to work in tandem with all the stakeholders to promote an inclusive political process. As far as the League of Arab States is concerned, I think they've played an extremely important role in initiating the intra-Iraqi dialogue process, which began in Cairo in November, which we were very privileged to be associated with. And at that meeting, many Iraqi political leaders who don't talk to each other in Iraq, except, you know, when they meet each other on TV, and there the debates are more shrill than, you know, there's more heat than sort of light in such debates because there's in front of a public audience. Here, they are in Cairo during the preparatory conference. They met, they discussed, they argued, they differed, but finally they signed on to a piece of paper which they could all sign on to, which was a very good first step. And that is planned after the government is formed. A larger Baghdad conference is envisaged, and we hope that will be able to carry this process further. And I believe that all of these are supplements to the Iraqi political process itself. They're not alternatives. They are supplements to, reinforcements for the Iraqi democratic political process. And I applaud the League of Arab States for having initiated this track, which can be very useful.
Maybe we have time for two quick questions.
Carol Conragan, USAID Iraq Reconstruction. I know that we didn't get the funding that we needed to continue our work in governance to support the legislative strengthening process, so we're really hoping that the UN is going to pick this up and provide technical expertise. Is that something you are willing to commit to?
Well, very much so. Governance is going to be a main theme of our activities, and within that, building capacity and helping with the constitution, these are going to be among the more salient features, and we are seeking to mobilize funds through agencies and through donors, for programs in this respect, and we will try to be as useful as possible in having a very effective and constitutional review process, because sooner or later that's going to have to happen, whether at the beginning of Parliament or somewhere halfway downwards, issues are going to, and those will sort of, contribute to the better governance and all, and, particularly, if federalism and how, where the Constitution can be interpreted in a number of ways. If you set up institutions envisaged by the Constitution, make the legislation, which is also envisaged by the Constitution, I think with respect to 60 or so articles, those can have a clarifying impact, and therefore it can become the framework for a more workable state process.
One last question.
Mm-hmm. Last year here on Massachusetts Avenue, Embassy Row, all of the different religions opened their doors for the first time and had a unity walk. We started at Washington Hebrew and went down to the Islamic Center and then on to the Gandhi Memorial. Since then, there's interest in doing in countries around the world, most notably Pakistan. But my question is if unity walks could be done in Iraq between the Sunnis and Shias, or is that very simplistic and idealistic? Or
it's not at all simplistic. It's an extremely good idea, because I think many proposals which were made in the aftermath, particularly of the Samarra tragedy, were for Sunni groups and Shia groups to get together and reconstruct some of the places which were damaged, including the Samarra shrine, even though it would need specialists to come in and, you know, the funding. But the very gesture itself, or to have joint prayers, you know, both Shias and Sunnis are Muslims and all, and there's absolutely no reason but they, why they shouldn't pray together. But in practice, you have the mosques and the Husseiniyat, and they often don't pray together. And all. So I think there have been a number of proposals in this respect. They should not only walk together, but they should work together and pray together. And I think this is something which has got to be emphasized. It's extremely important. The trouble is that these things get said one time, and then there's very little follow-up. So we need to work with civil society here to ensure that there is follow-up, because these things do bring about, a good impact on the, context and the parameters within which political processes happen.
I think we owe Ambassador Kazi a vote of thanks. I want to just note in concluding that USIP does work on ethnic and interreligious dialogue in Iraq. In fact, a large part of our effort is devoted in that area, and that we will continue working closely with the United Nations in that and on the Constitution and many other issues. Thank you, Ambassador Kazi.